Case number 22-7126. Alan Philip et al. Appellants versus Steve Tung for Suture Culture Basics. Mr. O'Donnell for the appellants. Mr. Fryman for the appellee.
Good morning, Mr. O'Donnell. You may proceed when you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honor, and may it please the court. Nicholas O'Donnell for the appellants, Alan Philip, Gerald Stiebel, and Jed Lieber. To understand the two questions posed by the Supreme Court on remand, it is essential to understand the role that the nationality of the victims has always played in this case. This case was brought in 2015, alleging a classical expropriation of the property at issue. If you look at paragraph 23 of the first complaint, which is the joint appendix at page 21, at 19 and 20, excuse me, it's very clear that the allegations were framed in terms of a classical expropriation. This is not a case that took a turn because of Simon 1. The allegations are that the Velfenschatz, the property issued in this case, that taking was discriminatory because the victims were Jewish, that it was not for a valid public purpose, it was part of the Nazis' larger theft of art, and that there was not fair and adequate consideration paid at the time. This appears verbatim in the first amended complaint at paragraph 25, joint appendix 177, and the second amended complaint, paragraph 25, joint appendix 908. Those allegations set out the elements that even the Prussian Foundation would have to concede address what international law prescribed. These allegations, as I said, did not change because of Simon. They were not an adaptation because of an intervening case. Even if you looked at Simon 1 as an outlier, which it was not at the time, it is extremely detailed. The allegations are extremely detailed about the role that being a German or not being a German by virtue of being a Jew, in so many words, played in why this transaction fits those elements.
So JA 908?
908, Your Honor, I believe is the second amending complaint.
Yeah, paragraph.
25 of the second amending complaint. Is verbatim paragraph 23 from the first complaint. If I've given you the wrong JA site, I apologize.
Yeah, I think it's on 903.
903, I'm sorry.
What paragraph?
Paragraph 25 of the operative complaint before you, the second amendment.
And that's the same as first amendment amended complaint paragraph?
25. And original complaint, paragraph 23. And when you compare them, they are verbatim the same. This case in 2015 invoked section 1605A3. The jurisdictional theory of this case has never changed. It is that this taking, that this transaction cannot be defended because of who the parties were. And if I say nothing else today, it is that the motivating philosophy of the taking state, the expropriating state, is to divide the universe into Germans and non-Germans. And I think Mr. Zell said this eloquently at the end. If you were to ask what the view of the expropriating state was in 1935 as to whether these three men were German nationals, the question answers itself. Of course, Germany did not. Germany could not have been more emphatic that this group of people was constitutionally ineligible.
Why is that the issue?
Because that is how you determine what the nationality of the parties is, Your Honor.
But what about the corporations? These individuals did not own anything, and their heirs didn't own anything except the interest in a corporation. Three corporations were German corporations.
The dealership
sold the artwork in 1935.
That is correct, Your Honor. We disagree with the Prussian Foundation, of course, as to whether the association had separate existence. But going to your question about the art dealer firms, that simply puts them in the same place as the plaintiffs in Helmerich on the remand. The American shareholders, whose Venezuelan corporation was taken. The Venezuelan corporation had no grievance under international law, this court held. But the American shareholders did. And in this case, what you have at the time of the taking is you have two shareholders who must be considered Dutch because they had left. And again, this goes to the standard of nationality of the men involved.
I have to interrupt you. That's not what you just said is not accurate according to the Supreme Court. Let me read to you. It says two of the consortium members fled the country following the sale.
That is, with all due respect to the opinion of the Supreme Court, you're not what the allegations of the complaint say and what the allegations of the complaint have always said.
So Chief Justice Roberts was wrong.
I guess in that respect, yes, Your Honor. Just as to the record of the case. The record of the case, it's not disputed, has never changed as to the sequence because it says by 1935, they had emigrated.
It says by, but the sale was in June.
Right, and 1935 began in January. So by 1935, without any more specific reference, is by the time 1935 began.
But your entire theory also depends on the ability of stateless individuals to assert expropriation claim.
Not entirely, Your Honor, because I think under the proper perspective, Rosenberg and Rosenbaum must be considered Dutch nationals at the time of the taking, which would place that into the context of what everybody, I think, agrees, putting aside the corporate question Judge Randolph addressed, is a classical expropriation, taking by a state of a foreign alien's property. But even as to the statelessness question, Your Honor, yes, we agree certainly with assignment plaintiffs. And I think the way to look at that is there is this small space, right, between the second restatement and the FSIA. There has to be, because as Mr. Zell pointed out, there is no analog in customary international law for the expropriation exception.
I want to get back to the question I asked you earlier. The allegations, I'm looking at your second amended complaint,
mm-hmm.
and just, you know, there are a number of paragraphs, but just take paragraph 32. On information and belief, the consortium was solely entitled to ownership rights in the period October 1929 to June 14, 1935, when the artwork had been in their possession. So the consortium sold it. And then according to the Supreme Court, the two individuals you're talking about moved to the Netherlands, right? So the taking, when the taking occurred, they were not Dutch citizens. And if that's essential, I don't find it, if it's essential that they be considered Dutch citizens, show me in your complaint where you'd make that allegation.
It's not essential, Your Honor. Well, as I said earlier, we made the allegation that by 1935 they had emigrated. So I understand what the opinion in Phillips says, but as to what the record is, which is the question, which is the record we're examining on the remand question, the allegations are as they've always, but it is not essential because stateless victims can bring these claims. They can espouse these claims, and that is for a couple of reasons. One is the comment D to section 175, which Mr. Zell alluded to, is that in that instance, the stateless alien can espouse the claim. And the other, as I said, in response to your question, Judge Pillard, is there has to be by definition, the very, at least slightest bit of space between the second restatement and the expropriation exception, because there is no analog at international law. Now, as the Supreme Court has said repeatedly, it is a departure, but not a radical departure. But it has to, that 1605A3 is a departure from international law, but it should not be considered a radical departure. Justice Thomas quoted that at me in oral argument. It is in various expropriation decisions by the Supreme Court since the 80s. But the departure has to include something greater than zero. Otherwise, the expropriation exception in that instance would have no, there would be nothing left.
Well, it's about the immunity. It pierces the immunity. I'm not sure how you're relying on comment D, the last clause of which is a stateless alien is without a remedy since there is no state withstanding to espouse his claim. And there you're relying on the notion that the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act creates?
Well, section D ends, unless I'm reading the wrong paragraph, under the rule stated in this section, a stateless alien may himself assert the responsibility of a state in those situations where an alien who is a national of another state may do so.
And the next sentence is, however, in those situations not covered by the rules stated in this section or by an international agreement providing some other remedy, a stateless alien is without a remedy.
But the FSA is that remedy.
Since
that,
there is no state withstanding to espouse his claim. And it seems somewhat circular whether the FSIA is referring to property taken in violation of international law. And then you're saying, well, violation of international law need not be separately provided, for example, as described in the second restatement or described in other sources of customary international law, because the statute itself accomplishes that codification?
That goes back to the fact of the FSIA and some of your questions earlier today, Your Honor, which is that the FSIA does provide that remedy. The FSIA does a lot of different things. And the day before the FSIA was enacted, an alien in that circumstance would have had no remedy anywhere.
So you are relying on the distinction between right and remedy that I alluded to at the beginning.
Yes.
Mark.
Yes. With that, I have about a minute left, so I'll reserve the balance of my time if there are no other questions. Thank you.
Morning, Mr. Fryman.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Jonathan Fryman for SBK. Your Honors, I do want to address some of the jurisdictional merits questions, which, of course, have consumed the bulk of this Court's questions and answers this morning, but I'm going to start by being a little more boring. And I'm going to turn to the law of forfeiture, and in particular, to the fact that the district court here found that the arguments that Mr. O'Donnell has been presenting have been forfeited. And this court's review of a district court forfeiture decision is under the abuse of discretion standard. And there's a reason for that, of course. The district court is uniquely positioned to know what has been argued and to take the time to look through the record in some detail. The GSS group decision is the one that makes clear that it's an abuse of discretion standard. And as Judge Calarcatelli found, none of this was argued below. Now, this is not a question of can you find a paragraph in the complaint that might support a legal theory. The question is, did they argue the legal theory at any previous time in this case before it got to the Supreme Court? And the answer to that question is no, as Judge Calarcatelli set out in very clear detail in her decision. All along, they chose a path. It had a jurisdictional theory. Their theory was that the expropriation exception allowed claims for property taken in violation of the international law of genocide. That was their theory. But we all know that there was a longstanding consensus, as Judge Breyer put it in the Altman case and as the Supreme Court put it in this case, that the domestic takings rule existed. And therefore, they always had another path. They always could have said from the beginning, no, we don't fall within the domestic takings rule because we are not nationals of Germany. None of the companies were nationals of Germany or whatever their theory would be. None of the individuals who owned the companies, and you can ignore the company's corporate status, whatever their theory would have been. None of that is argued. You won't find any of that in any of their briefs to the district court. You won't find any of it in their briefs to this court the last time around. It's first brought up in a single paragraph in response to our assertion that it was waived in their Supreme Court merits brief.
What about the allegations of the complaint, and what about the fact that you have consistently been arguing against that position? It doesn't seem like in those circumstances that there's any notice problem, which is really what this whole doctrine goes to, the preservation. It's a discretionary doctrine. You've been alert to this issue all along. Nothing about it's the sequence of the decision is obviously keeps you within litigation for longer than you'd like, but these are complicated questions.
These are complicated questions, Your Honor. And I don't think this court needs to address them because I don't think the forfeiture law of this circuit requires there to be some sort of particularized prejudice. But there is prejudice here. And I know Your Honor had some doubts about this in the last argument. But there's prejudice of multiple forms, and I'd like to go through them for you. First of all, I do want to reiterate the notion of the fact that I'm, of course, representing a foreign sovereign, and the very purpose of the Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act is immunity from suit. And in the Supreme Court's decision in Helmreich, the Supreme Court makes clear, no, we're not going to adopt this non-frivolous standard, because that's going to drag the litigation out. That's going to make the litigation keep going. Right? Well, forfeiture's even worse. Right? If we're going to excuse forfeiture in this circumstance, we're saying plaintiff can bring one theory, bring it all the way up to the Supreme Court, go all the way back down, and then just start with another theory.
Who goes all the way up to the Supreme Court?
Well, we do because in fact, that's part of the notion of the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act.
Exactly. Just saying that, you know, it's a little rich, given that it is the prerogative of a nation state to appeal whenever sovereign immunity is denied, that the appeals that are repeatedly triggered by the nation state are then adverted to as a source of delay. And I just, you know, I think this is a tough question where there are multiple legal grounds and, you know, where you want to have to test it all the way to the highest court. And that's absolutely your prerogative. But, you know, there's a tension between resolving things efficiently and giving the sovereign immediate rights to appeal. You recognize that.
I hear what Your Honor is saying, but respectfully, if we had not appealed, we would have been moving to discovery. We would have been moving to factual discovery because the district court, in fact, found that there was jurisdiction under a theory that proved to be wrong, that the Supreme Court rejected.
And you might have prevailed on facts.
We might have, but the point of the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act is immunity from suit, not immunity from liability.
I understand. I just think it's very difficult to get you everything that you want.
Yeah.
You know, fully reviewed accuracy and have the case decided yesterday.
Well, let me make, we're not asking for yesterday, Your Honor, but let me make clear, I think it's important to get into the details a little bit of the procedural sequence here. Again, this is why we have an abuse of discretion standard, but there was an original complaint. We moved to dismiss. One of the things we moved to dismiss that original complaint was on the basis of the domestic takings rule. They amended their first amended complaint with our permission. They amended and they didn't address it. They didn't raise they didn't say we're Dutch or we're stateless. They did say we were persecuted, but they didn't say we're Dutch or we're stateless or companies don't count. That wasn't in their amended complaint. And then we moved to dismiss again. We moved to dismiss the first amended complaint. And in their opposition, they didn't say, oh, well, we're Dutch or we're stateless or companies don't count. They didn't make any of those arguments there.
What do you win if you prevail on the forfeiture argument?
If the district court was correct that these arguments were forfeited, then the case is over.
That case is over, but the adjudication would have been on the basis that these people were German citizens or nationals, which would not prevent them from bringing another suit claiming that they were Dutch.
Well, Your Honor, I'm here on this suit, and I believe in this suit it was forfeited. As to what they choose to do in the future, that would be up to them.
It would preclude them, wouldn't it? That's claim preclusion, and it includes arguments, whether you've raised them or not, that arise out of the common nucleus of operative facts.
So I suppose there
might. I think that would be res judicata, and we're not called on to decide that. But
right. It might well be res judicata. There might be statute of limitations issues. I don't know, Your Honor, but that would be a decision for the plaintiffs to make and arguments to be had in a further case if that's something that they decided to do. Let me turn to the minute. Let me just mention one other element very quickly of prejudice here. One of the grounds we moved to dismiss on originally was forum nonconvenience. And of course, we didn't have the advantage at the time of knowing that they were going to claim to be Dutch nationals, of knowing that Dutch nationality law might come into play, or that they weren't German nationals and that we would need to show that, in fact, the German law of nationality was relevant in addition to whatever other German bodies of law were relevant. Well, if we'd been able to raise that at the forum nonconvenience argument stage, that might have tipped the scales for the district court. And that decision, of course, also would have been under abuse of the discretion standard. So that's another kind of prejudice that was suffered here by them not raising that argument then. Again, we think the argument was forfeited, but I do, in the time that's left, want to address the merits. Ms. Randolph, as you pointed out, the companies are the ones who were the members of the consortium. And I just want to point out, this is unequivocal in the operative complaint here. Paragraph one, the very first paragraph of the complaint, which you can find on page 896 of the joint appendix, in talking about the Welfenschatz owners, says those owners were a consortium of three art dealer firms in Frankfurt. It's their allegation. It's clear that three German companies were the members of the consortium that owned the property that was allegedly taken. Likewise, you can turn to paragraph 32 of the complaint, which one of you asked about earlier. That's on page 911 of the joint appendix. And here again, it says, only these three art dealer firms, and then it names them, were the signatories to the contracts of 1929, that's when the Gulf and Shots was bought, and 1935, that's when it was sold. So the plaintiffs themselves have admitted that this property was owned by corporate entities in Germany, in Frankfurt. They have never argued that these companies were not German, nor could they. These were companies that were on the commercial register in Frankfurt, as they themselves have acknowledged. And there is no doubt that under international law, the corporate reality has to be recognized. This court holds that in Helmreich, and it's a longstanding customary international law principle. It goes back to the Barcelona traction case, which is cited in this court's decision in Helmreich, as well as in the United States amicus brief in Helmreich. So it's very clear, Dr. Randolph, going to your earlier questions, that yes, you do have to care that companies owned this, that this was not individuals. So
would you turn to, while we're on the appendix, I think it's 1019, 18 and 19.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I missed that page.
1018.
1018? Your Honor, that appears to be, if it's 1018 of the joint appendix, I see a...
1018 and 1019.
Yes, I see a list in German on page 1018.
Prussian stamp tax on the right?
Yes, I do see.
You there? Okay.
Yes.
On the left, is that the bill of sale? It's in German.
Your Honor, this is, I believe, a list of the items. It's part of the 1935 contract, which begins on page 1011.
Right, and it's dated Berlin, June 14th, 1935, which was the date of the sale.
Right. That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, now look at the next page. And it's a Prussian stamp tax, apparently imposed on the sale. And down the bottom, this is the translation. It gives the date June 14th, 1935, expected, right? You see that?
Expected, illegible on 614.
Okay, then look at the third entry. It's Mr. Rosenbaum and Mr. Rosenberg, and their address is Amsterdam.
Yes, Your Honor.
Am I to infer from that they were living in Amsterdam at the time of the sale?
They may have been, Your Honor. The complaint, as Mr. O'Donnell's correctly notes, states that they had emigrated to the Netherlands sometime between 1933 and 1935.
But it's not clear when.
But let me go to
it. Well, the reason I'm asking you is because undertaking law, that particularly as the Supreme Court interpreted here, the question is what the nationality was at the time of the sale.
That's correct.
So if they were not in Amsterdam at the time of the sale, then the nationality clearly, seems to me, is German, whether by the individuals or the corporations, either way. But if they were in Amsterdam at the time of the sale, it might be a different matter, particularly since if you go further in the appendix at page 1020, can you turn to that?
Yes, sir.
They're listed as former owners of the company.
Yes, Your Honor. So let me say two things.
And there's another entry, I've forgotten where it is. It indicates that by this time, by September of 1935, their company was defunct.
In fact, the complaint states that the company continued operations in Frankfurt until 1937, with one of their brothers running the operations in Frankfurt.
Oh, I think you're right. Yeah, I have to correct myself. I think it was a 1941 entry that said it was defunct.
I believe that they allege that the company continued operations until 1937 and that it was removed from the commercial register in 1938. That is, that the company became defunct in 1938. Our expert on German law notes that this is a company in Winesdown, and that these two individuals are acting for the company in Winesdown, and they're, of course, collecting the assets before they're distributed to the owners of the company, but it's still a company, and that's why it's listed as three. That is, they're not separately listed as three and four. It's a single unit. But going to your, so it's still a company, and Barcelona Traction and this court's decision in Helmreich are still relevant. But let me go to the deeper question that Your Honor asked, which is, what if we ignore corporate nationality? Were these two men Dutch nationals at the time of the alleged taking of the property? And the answer to that is unequivocally no. Under the international law of nationality, you look to each state's nationality law. And there is nothing in the record the plaintiffs have put forward suggesting that these two individuals were no longer German nationals in June of 1935 or that they were Dutch nationals. In fact, the only materials that this court has in the appellate record are the laws, the relevant laws, as well as experts' analysis of the laws of both the Netherlands and of Germany. And under German law, Professor Jan Thiessen points out that these people clearly were nationals of Germany. The mere fact of leaving Germany, even if you did not intend to return, did not mean that you lost your German nationality under German law. By the same consequence, Professor Kampfens, with regard to Dutch nationality law, and she attaches all of that law, which was available to the district court, under Dutch nationality law, it was simply not legally possible to become a national within 2 years. Under Dutch nationality law, it was a minimum period of time of 5 years before you could even apply for nationality. Right? Someone doesn't become a national just because they go there, even if they intend to live there. You don't become a national of the United States because you come here on a work permit or a tourist visa, or you come here as an undocumented person. You become a U.S. national if, in fact, you apply for and receive either legal permanent residency or citizenship in the United States. Same in the Netherlands. In the Netherlands, you needed to wait 5 years to even apply. Well, 5 years, even taking them at their, you know, they've left themselves a two-year window. If we take the beginning of that window, 1933, they couldn't have become Dutch nationals until at the earliest 1938. So we're talking about years after the sale in issue here. And again, returning to German nationality law, it's clear that they were German nationals in June of 1935, and they put forward nothing. Their argument simply is ignore that. They say ignore what the actual laws of Germany and the actual laws of the Netherlands are, and instead just look at the totality of the circumstances. You decide in the abstract what constitutes nationality. You decide if a country and a person have enough of a link. And I want to point out that they have nothing to support this. There's no source, a steep climb, I believe, Judge Pillar, you referred to earlier. It's a steep climb to find a principle of established customary international law, which is, of course, based on the practice of nations, other nations, based on a felt sense of legal obligation. Well, it's a steep climb indeed, and they pointed to nothing that suggests that someone loses the nationality of their birth because of mistreatment or because of some totality of circumstances analysis. They don't cite a single case. There's no international law on that whatsoever. What they're trying to do is the same problem that happened in the earlier Simon decision. They're trying to put a square peg in a round hole.
Is there any de facto statelessness by virtue of the persecution?
There's not, Your Honor. There's no established. Matter of fact, if you look at, there was reference earlier to Section 175 of the Second Restatement. And that was not raised by plaintiffs in this case. I know that they forfeited the whole thing, but they didn't even raise that restatement section in their appellate briefing in this case. But if you look at that, if you look at the second reporter's note to that section, you'll see the reporter saying, I'm paraphrasing, but the reporter says, wow, you know, the law of statelessness is really not clear. And that's why we're trying to develop international conventions to deal with it. And they reference something called the Harvard Draft, which is a convention that I believe never entered into force. The desire is to apply human rights principles to the notion of nationality because of stateless people, you know, not having any kind of protection. But as the Supreme Court held in Philip, we look to the relevant body of law. Human rights law exists on its own. Nationality law is separate from that. And speaking to Judge Pillard's point earlier, Judge Childs, the international law of expropriation is the relevant body of law that we look to in claims under the expropriation exception.
And then with respect to the forfeiture issue, does it matter about plaintiff being in the status of an appellee with respect to the argument?
No, because they're the plaintiff below. So we're looking at what happened in the district court, as Your Honor knows well. We're looking at what their arguments were. So We moved to dismiss, and in their opposition to the motion to dismiss, or in their amendment the first time around, they could have tried to plead around or argue around these issues. They didn't. That argument was never raised. So that's always the case for a plaintiff's forfeiture, that a plaintiff needs to respond to the arguments made by a defendant in a motion to dismiss or a motion for summary judgment.
Sir Fryman, if one were to move beyond the forfeiture and address the question of at least statelessness, if not Dutch nationality, is it preferable to rest on the lack of customary international law supporting the notion that individuals become stateless by virtue of experiencing persecution, or alternatively, to hold that a state's taking of a de facto stateless person's property, assuming that the person is de facto stateless, does not violate international law?
Well, I think this court can and should present both, right? There is no customary that precludes a state from taking the property of a stateless person. So that's unquestionable. But the other proposition is clear as well. In either event,
even a de jure stateless person, no international law for that.
That's correct.
It's not just a question of no nation state to champion that person's.
Right. What Philip, obviously the central animating principles of Philip in describing what the international law of expropriation talks about, the traditions of international law being concerned with the relationships between states, not between states and individual persons. Human rights law later emerged to deal with the problems of the state's mistreatment of its own people. But with regard to the traditional international law of takings, which is what we're looking at here, that only involves relations between states. So there's no harm to a state that occurs when a stateless person's property is taken. And I guess one way to make that very clear for you is if we imagine that the state takes the property of a person from another state, it's that other state that traditionally has the claim that can espouse that claim. And that state can get the money. That state decides whether it gives the money to the individual or not. It belongs to that other state, James and Moore versus Reed, going way back. There's no, in the international law of takings, even in that circumstance, which clearly falls outside the domestic takings rule, there's no concern with the rights of the individual. This just isn't the body of law that addresses that. That's what human rights law is.
Anything else? Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Brown.
Thank you, Your Honors.
One minute remaining for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. To quickly address where Mr. Fryman ended, if that interpretation of Section 1605A3 were correct, there would be no expropriation exception because all foreign nationals fully vested with the citizenship of another country would be equally without remedy, as Mr. Fryman just said. It would be for their state to bring. The FSIA doesn't do that. With regard to the preservation question, it cannot seriously be suggested that we never argued or said these people weren't German. We said so in so many words in the complaint, in the amended complaint, in our opposition to the motion to dismiss. And
I believe you only said they emigrated.
No,
don't believe
we
there's
said
any assertion about nationality.
We said the plaintiffs were officially no longer considered German. This is in our opposition brief. The SBK can't decide whether it's the brief or the complaint that controls, but either way, we said it over and over and over again. And today, as Mr. Zell said, is Yom HaShoah, and for the Federal Republic of Germany to argue that somehow it is unfair to embrace the context of what it did is absurd. And the source of international law that I would point to is what everyone outside this case understands to be true, which is that the Nazi Party refused to recognize Jews as Germans. Thank you.
Thank you all. The case is submitted.